From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now, a big win at the Supreme Court today for supporters of abortion rights. By a vote of 5-4, the court struck down a Louisiana law that required doctors who perform abortions to have admitting privileges at nearby hospitals.
A district court found that the law would have left just one doctor at one clinic to perform abortions in the entire state. Chief Justice John Roberts sided with the liberals on the court in striking it down. NPR Justice Correspondent Carrie Johnson has been looking at the decision. Hi, Carrie.
Hi, Robin.
And we know that Justice Stephen Breyer wrote the majority opinion. He said the court agreed with the district court's finding that the Louisiana law offers no significant health benefit and that it creates a substantial obstacle for women seeking abortions. Tell us more.
So Justice Breyer found that this Louisiana statute the court invalidated today was almost word for word identical to a similar statute in Texas that the Supreme Court had struck down in 2016. The difference this time around was that there are two new members of the court appointed by President Donald Trump, Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh. However, because Chief Justice Roberts sided narrowly with the court's four liberals, this law in Louisiana was struck down. The analysis was similar to the previous case in Texas. Stephen Breyer basically said that the Louisiana state law did not really have a compelling interest based in women's health. And in fact, it imposed a significant burden on their access to abortion without really much of any health benefit being promoted. So he found the law to be unconstitutional.
Yep. And did Chief Justice Roberts have the same reasoning?
Not at all. In fact, John Roberts wrote a very, very, very narrow concurrence, Robin. He said he had dissented in the Texas case. He thinks this ruling is the wrong ruling for a lot of reasons, but he felt compelled to side with the liberals in this case to uphold what he called stare decisis, this issue of precedent. And he thinks it's important to promote accountability and predictability in the development of legal rules because this case was so similar to the court's ruling in Texas, the Texas case in 2016. He sided with the court majority here.
And what kind of reaction have you been hearing from both sides?
You know, at oral argument, Justice Breyer pointed out that these issues, abortion rights issues, generate very strong feelings. And in fact, that has come out very strongly in the statements today. Abortion rights groups have pointed out that they didn't think this case was going to be a hard one at all because it was so similar to Texas. But they point out it was a narrow and precarious ruling. And they point out that there are something like 16 other challenges moving through the courts on abortion rights at this point, and they're not sure which way this high court is going to lean in the future. Opponents of abortion rights are very concerned. They are criticizing John Roberts for siding with the liberals here. And they basically say that it makes it all the more important that President Trump win re-election. President Trump, who has basically vowed to name Supreme Court justices in the future that would try to strike down that landmark Roe v. Wade precedent, Robin.
We'll talk about the bigger picture. Conservative lawmakers in a number of states passed a range of abortion bans last year, including Alabama's ban on all abortions except when a woman's health is at serious risk. Abortion rights opponents want to see these bans make it to the Supreme Court so that the court could potentially revisit Roe versus Wade. So where does today's decision fit into this larger effort? Obviously a setback, yeah.
There are any number of ongoing challenges based on precedent in Roe v. Wade. And in fact, several people do believe that the court will be obliged to take up another abortion rights case, abortion access case in the future. The question is whether those cases can be sufficiently distinguished from the laws that the court has now struck down in Texas and Louisiana. Some of them may be. There's another issue, which is that in this case in Louisiana, they brought up at the Supreme Court for the first time the issue of whether abortion doctors who perform abortions could actually stand in for patients as plaintiffs. That was a serious issue in this case. It was ultimately decided the other way. But there are some complicating factors regarding the development of how these cases start that could come into play moving forward. Certainly, there are people out there with very strong opinions, and they want to see the Supreme Court rule the other way on an abortion rights challenge in the future.
And just very briefly, just have a couple seconds. Was this a surprise? You say, you know, proponents of abortion rights didn't seem surprised, but was it a surprise?
I think Some people who had been opponents of several of the Supreme Court precedents, such as Roe v. Wade, were bitterly disappointed today that John Roberts sided with liberals in this case.
Yeah. NPR Justice Correspondent Carrie Johnson, thank you.
My pleasure.
Well, beaches in Miami and Fort Lauderdale will be closed for the 4th of July holiday weekend. Florida is among at least a dozen states that are pausing or rolling back their plans to reopen businesses and public places as coronavirus case counts hit record highs in much of the country. And yesterday, deaths from COVID-19 topped 500,000 worldwide. Let's bring in Caitlin Rivers. She's an epidemiologist at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security. Caitlin, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And at least 31 states now reporting a rise in cases. This is not going in the right direction. What are you seeing in this data?
There are a number of states, particularly in the South and West, that are experiencing a resurgence. And so these were states that largely were not hit hard early in the outbreak. They had a little bit more of a quiet experience. But in the last couple of weeks, things have really started to pick up, which is concerning.
What do you think is causing it?
Well, I think some of it had to do with reopening. I think that as we moved from staying home to slow the spread to reintroducing activities in the community, I think those are new infection risks. And I think we're still learning a lot about what those risks are and what settings are at higher risk. But it does seem, given the timeline, that reopening probably played a role.
The Vice President Mike Pence did something of an about-face on the issue of wearing masks this weekend in Dallas. Of course, Texas is one of those states that is very hard hit right now. Here he is speaking over the weekend.
Wash your hands, avoid touching your face, and wear a mask wherever it's indicated, or wherever you're not able to practice the kind of social distancing that would prevent the spread of the coronavirus.
How important is it that finally somebody at the top levels of the administration is saying wear a mask?
I do think it's really helpful. I think right now there's so much opportunity for public health officials and our leaders to really communicate to the public what they should be doing to keep themselves and their families safe. And I do think wearing a face covering while spending time in the community is one of those really important interventions. So I'm glad to hear that it's getting more prominence in our public discussions.
But with infections this widespread in places like Florida, Texas, and Arizona, is wearing a mask in public enough to make a big difference?
I don't think it would be enough to turn the corner without any other supplemental interventions, but I think of it as a layering strategy. Many places have moved to close bars, which I think is helpful. There's also communications in places that are hard hit that people should be spending more time at home than they may have previously. And so I think adding together those different interventions will cumulatively help to turn the corner.
Should those states shut down in the way many states shut down in March?
I think that high-risk activities, bars that I just mentioned, I think is one of them. It would be good to walk back on those while we figure out how we are going to manage transmission and resurgence in these areas. I don't think we're headed toward a complete shutdown, but I would not be surprised if these high-risk activities do go back on pause.
So as the number of cases go up, we haven't really seen the same number of deaths spike in the same way. Now, we know deaths are a lagging indicator, so do you think that's just a matter of time until we start to see the death rate go up?
Well, I am certainly hopeful that we will continue to see a decline in the number of deaths, but it does seem like with a increase in the number of cases, some of that will be reflected in the death data, unfortunately. But we also are seeing that many of the new cases, particularly in Florida and Arizona, are in young people, and young people are at lower risk of severe illness than older adults. And so there is some reason to hope that we will continue to see lower rates of hospitalization and death. But of course, it's not just young people. We are all bridges to people who are more vulnerable. So we should not mistake those current patterns as being kind of a fixed trend. There's going to be risk for everyone.
This is sort of remarkable. There are only two states right now that are seeing a decline in cases. That is Rhode Island and Connecticut. What does that tell you? Because it seems like states that had got this under control, like Massachusetts and New York, are no longer in that category. What does that tell you?
It is true that not many states are properly declining, but there are a number of additional states that got to a fairly low number of new cases and have been able to maintain that. And I think that's an important lesson, that it is possible to reopen to some extent and to incorporate more community activities without seeing a resurgence. And so I think we should take that as inspiration, that for places that are in a bit more of a tough place, it will be possible to turn things around and to kind of hold tight until we get a vaccine.
And yet the 4th of July holiday is coming up at the end of this week. There will be some beaches in Florida that are going to be closed to try to slow down infections. What's your message to Americans who are considering what to do this coming weekend?
The virus is very much still with us, and we all need to still be taking precautions to prevent transmission. I would recommend limiting time spent with other people, but if you do have get-togethers, I would prefer that those happen outside and that attendees wear masks. And of course, there's always opportunities for hand hygiene and social distancing, those 6 feet.
Caitlin Rivers is an epidemiologist at Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
And if you can, I'm going to ask you to go now to hereandnow.org to look at a picture of a statue. If you can't, I'll describe it. It's Boston's post-Civil War Emancipation Memorial, a replica of one in Washington, D.C. by sculptor Thomas Ball. You may be familiar with both, but if not, it's huge. Abraham Lincoln in brown bronze, standing, towering next to a kneeling, cowering black man. Lincoln's arm is stretched out over the man's head as if, what, protecting him, blessing him, gesturing for him to get up? The black man, a former slave, has broken shackles on his wrists and ankles. He looks tentative, maybe about his unfamiliar future. In my mind, he's about to stand, freed by Lincoln's bloody Civil War. An inscription reads, "A race set free and a country at peace. Lincoln rests from his labors." I must admit, when I read that, and I often do, I love this statue. I do have a little flash of, well, talk about resting from your labors. Perhaps the slave is the one who's really tired. But anyway, that's what I always saw. Lincoln helping a new nation to its feet. It makes me cry. What do you see? And what does Tory Bullock see? He is a Boston musician and activist. I am white. He is black. Tory, what do you see in the Emancipation Memorial?
I see a beautiful piece of work. I see great craftsmanship. And I also see a grown black man looking like he is a coffee table or a pet. I see a large white man standing over this black man, fully clothed. Attention to detail is impeccable. He has actual eyeballs with pupils and everything in it. His beard is everything. And then the man beneath him, the slave, is pretty much nude for the most part. He has a little cloth covering his waist, but he still has shackles on his wrists, even though they're not necessarily shackled to the ground. They still have shackles. And even though it doesn't look like he's about to get up, it looks like he is frozen in time forever on his knees. This man will never stand. He will always be on his knees. So for me, I see a white savior helping people who would have never been able to do it on their own.
Tory, since hearing from you about this, I've spoken to other friends, a black adult friend who talks about bringing his child by this statue and how horrible a moment it is for the child to see that. And he has to explain what that is, that man on his knees. Have you always had this reaction to the statue?
It's funny because it felt as though you were describing my experience when I was a child, because that's the exact same experience I had with the statue. I remember the first time I saw it downtown. This highly controversial piece of art is nestled right in Park Square in Boston between Marzano's and Legal Seafood. So I was on my way down there with my family to go get something to eat, and I vividly remember seeing this statue, seeing a person that looked just like me on his knees. So that's a journey that started when I was a child, and I'm a grown man, and it's still sitting with me.
Just explain that, sitting with you. You sounds like you almost have a physical reaction.
There is a physical reaction. I think, well, it was very jarring when I first saw it as a child, like, whoa, what is this? But being completely honest, now it's kind of just a numb, dulling, why is this still up emotion whenever I see it. Whenever I pass it, it just really reminds me of what people's perception of me is. And it feels less about, hey, you should remember your proud ancestors and your proud history. And it feels more about you should remember your place because you're beneath me.
Well, Tory Bullock, because of you, I've been seeing this statue through new eyes. You know, none of this occurred to me, I'm willing and kind of embarrassed to say. You started a petition to take this statue down. It's gone national. Thousands have signed it. Boston is having a public comment meeting tomorrow night. Over the weekend, there were protests at the original statue in Washington. The president says he's issued an order for penalties for anyone who takes down a federal monument, but there already is a law in place. The Park Service says any removal has to go through Congress. But you know there are also dissenting voices, and many are Black and descendants of the real Black man in this statue. His name is Archer Alexander, you know this, a slave who actually helped the Union during the Civil War, running miles to tell Union soldiers when he overheard his owner say a bridge was going to be blown up. He's not named on the statue, that's a problem, but it's thought to be the first statue of an African American in this country. Freed Black slaves paid for it. Does any of that, you know, maybe alter your view?
No, not at all, actually. Being completely, that's one of the main arguments that I hear people have is that, hey, guys, you should be proud of this. This is your story of Archer Alexander. It really makes me feel like, so if he's really one of the most powerful African-American figures that we have in our history, why do we have a statue of him naked? No one would ever want to see a statue of President Lincoln without a shirt and pants on. And in terms of the we paid for it argument, my favorite response to that is actually a quote, if you don't mind me reading it right now.
Sure.
It says, the $17,000 raised for the memorial was an enormous sum coming from a newly emancipated people. Predictably, none of these donors had a say in the monument's design. Instead, the all-white sanitary commission led by Reverend William G. Elliott turned to Massachusetts-born artist Thomas Ball. This was written on Medium.com by Raul Fernandez. Those Black people who were involved, put their money up, they weren't involved in the creative process, so it's not even their vision.
By the way, Fernandez is a dean at Boston University, but there are, again, descendants of Archer Alexander who embrace this. Keith Winstead told the Boston Globe he thinks it's a tribute to Alexander. He was breaking his shackles and standing. That's how he sees it. Cedric Turner says taking it down would be like wiping out the story of those freed slaves who paid for it. Others ask, do you wipe out, I don't know, the history of slavery?
Yeah, no, I think that there's this fear that by somehow getting rid of this statue that all Black Americans are going to forget that slavery happened. And I can guarantee you that the 400 to 500 years that African Americans spent in slavery left such an imprint that we will remember it if we don't see a statue reminding us of it all the time.
Yeah. Is there anything that can be done to leave it standing? For instance, if a Black sculptor was to design another statue, it's maybe 100 yards in the foreground. It is Archer Alexander, upright, dressed, walking proudly, leaving shackles behind. Maybe on a path, there's shackles on the path. I'm obviously not the sculptor here, but is there a way that it could be put into context for you?
For me, two things. First, I am a creative. I'm an artist myself. And
right.
I think it would actually be pretty disrespectful to kind of put something attached to or around to influence this kind of piece of art. I don't want to touch the art itself at all. And I also think that putting something kind of a standing Archer Alexander, fully clothed, and putting that next to him, it is still always remember that he was a slave. Every movie that comes out about my Black history is about slavery. Our images are slavery. I just don't understand. It feels like everyone else is way more obsessed with continuing to carry the image of slavery than actual Black people are.
Mm. What would you like to see?
Honestly, I think this is an amazing opportunity. What I want to see, I don't even want to see this thing destroyed. I don't want to see it melted down. I don't want to see it pulled down violently. A lot of effort and work went into that piece, and I truly respect this piece of artwork now. That's not something I can say at the beginning of this, but I do respect this piece of artwork. And because I respect it, I feel like this should be put in a museum somewhere where we can learn about it and have these articulate conversations that we want to have, but we can have it inside of a proper space for it and not next to legal seafoods out in public. And the process in which to get there is something that I feel that the entire country can look at and say, hey, this is how we can do this. Instead of just ripping down these statues, we can gather the public support, make some noise, and then our city officials are going to have to create a process for us to actually facilitate that.
And by the way, for those who are the descendants of Archer Alexander, who've been so proud of this, having it in a museum would also address their needs.
Yeah, no, I'm telling you, I really feel like putting it in a museum is the ultimate compromise. Putting them in an organized space where they can truly be curated, and I can walk and see the Emancipation Memorial and see all of the history, all of the love that went into it, all of the money that went into it. Because as awesome as this history is that everyone's bringing up about this memorial now, no one knew this. Mm-hmm. No one was talking about this. There's no plaque. So I think to put it into a space where we can actually acknowledge that history would be 30 times better than actually leaving it up in public right now.
It feels, too, like it might also rob whites of the luxury of looking at a statue and going, yep, Lincoln, I'm good.
Oh, yes, yes, that is so true, so true.
Tori Bullock, again, thank you. You have made me look at something in a way far different than I ever did. And to think that, you know, people that I love who are of color were having any discomfort when I was not is not a good feeling. Thank you so much for your work on this and your thoughts on this.
Thank you. Can I thank you for something real quick, Robin?
Sure.
Cool. I want to thank you for taking a second look. And I want to thank all the people like you that are taking second looks, because honestly, you're not in the minority. So many people are saying, I never saw a problem with it. It actually looks like a great piece of artwork. But those same people are saying, it bothers people around me. So because it bothers people around me, my friends, my family, I'm going to take a second look and see what's really going on and to listen. And the fact that you and people like you are choosing to look and listen is so powerful. So thank you.
Oh, well, at least we can do. Thank you so much. Great to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you.
And your thoughts, welcome. HereAndNow.org. A public service reminder to the millions of Americans who opted to file their taxes later this year. Tax day is in 2 weeks. I know. In what twilight zone is tax day in July? This one. Jill Schlesinger, business analyst for CBS News and host of Jill on Money, is here to tell us what we need to know. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
So taxes normally due April 15th, now July 15th. The thinking was the extension would let people hold on to their money a little longer because of the coronavirus shutdown. So give us a sense how many people actually did that and are now filing in July.
Well, according to the IRS, they have received 138.2 million individual income tax returns as of June 19th. That's down from 144.5 million a year ago. But you know what? That probably overstates what's going on, because the IRS says that current total includes a bunch of people who filed just to get the economic impact payments by those who would not usually file tax returns. And of course, as usual, those who file earliest are those who are usually due a refund. Right now, the average refund, it's running at just over $2,700.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you also tell us the households that took advantage of the extension the most are the wealthiest. Households making over $1 million, 56% of them delayed, whereas households making less than $75,000, only about 15% of them delayed. Now, maybe it was to get the, you know, the payout from the government, but that seems like the opposite of the intention.
Yeah, I think the Treasury probably was pretty panic-stricken back in March, April, and they were erring on the side of providing quite a wide berth to taxpayers. Like, we didn't know a lot of information at that time. And if you think about when they were delaying it, we were unsure how many taxpayers had the bandwidth to file taxes. Older people who were getting sick, could they get to their records? You know, it was kind of just like, let's put it out there. As far as those wealthier people, of course that makes sense, right? Because if you owe money, you want to wait until the last possible moment to file. Mm-hmm. It's usually higher income Americans who owe more than they withheld from the tax year that they're referencing.
Yeah. Well, Treasury Secretary Mnuchin said last week he's considering another extension beyond the upcoming July 15th deadline. So what would be the thinking there?
I think that's a head scratcher. I don't get it because I think it seems like a terrible idea. Right now, if you file for, you know, if you're ready to file for July 15th, go ahead and do it. And if you need more time, we have something called an extension. It's Form 4868. You can file for an extension until October 15th. I have no idea why he's considering this and what the real purpose would be. It seems ridiculous to me.
Well, I mean, but it is a soothing headline, you know, for people who don't know they can already get an extension, you know, for to hear that there might be another one. But you say some 30 to 35 million Americans still haven't received that stimulus check we were talking about. This is according to MarketWatch, and many it's because of tax reasons. So, is there anything people should do now to ensure they get that $1,200?
You should bookmark my favorite website, which is irs.gov. And there is actually a section about coronavirus. And you can see it's irs.gov/coronavirus/economic impact payments. There's a tool that you can use to track your payment. There's also a tool for those who didn't file their tax returns. It's a non-filer tool. So go get that money if you're entitled to it. Don't wait around. irs.gov. It's actually pretty easy to navigate it.
Jill Schlesinger, business analyst for CBS News, host of Jill on Money. Jill, that is so sweet that that is your favorite website.
I mean, after Here and Now.
We'll link people at hereandnow.org. Jill, thank you.
Take care.
The UN says 1.5 billion kids around the world have been affected by school closures due to the pandemic. As school districts now look ahead to the fall, many parents are wondering if classrooms will stay closed. And if they do, what does that mean for their children's education? Robin Lake is director of the Center for Reinventing Public Education in Seattle. She's been surveying school districts across the country to see if she can help answer that question. Robin, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Good to have you. And what does the research tell us about how far behind kids have already fallen academically because of this pandemic?
Yes. Well, it's something of a lost year for a lot of kids. So researchers are estimating that though kids' experiences will have varied very much last year, it can be expected that a lot of kids will have lost maybe about half of the math content they should have received last year and maybe a third of the reading. But as I say, that will not be evenly distributed.
Right, because not all school districts are created equal. What kind of discrepancies are you seeing?
Yeah, so when we look across the country, we see that 1 in 3 districts typically really required teachers to teach last year, so provided something kind of a coherent education, if you think about it that way. And even fewer, 1 in 5, asked teachers to do live instruction, so really, you know, engaging with kids in the classroom. So that's a lot of variation, especially in rural districts where there wasn't a lot of access to Wi-Fi and devices, that kind of thing. Students with disabilities may not have had access to their services. And some parents are much more involved than other parents, of course, in terms of being able to take the time to support their kids' learning.
So you're saying 1 in 5, 20%. Of schools across the country offered live instructions from their teachers. That is not very much. And as a result of that, you're also saying that kids are behind in math and in reading. So, I mean, what are the consequences of being that far behind in these core skills?
Well, it really depends on what we do. If we do nothing, there will be significant repercussions and kids will pay the price. They'll be struggling to catch up. If they miss some foundational skills, you know, think about little kids missing or, you know, just building blocks for reading or older kids missing some important algebra skills. They may never catch up in the way that we hope they will. But the great news is that that doesn't have to be the case. We know what to do to catch kids up, and it'll certainly be challenging next year. But I, you know, my view is we've really got to double down and get serious quickly.
Okay, let's get into what it is that we do to catch up. My first thought is summer school. Is that right? I mean, does that even exist in this pandemic world that we live in?
Yeah, summer school, it seemed to me, would be an important opportunity for catching kids up. A lot of school districts, about 60% by our count, are offering some kind of summer school. However, it's a little disappointing to look at what that really looks like. Most of those summer school opportunities are voluntary. They're really aimed for kids who need to recover some credits or something, and more of a desperate situation. So not a lot of summer school happening, really.
Okay.
And not a lot of, enrichment.
Well, that doesn't sound good. So what do we do? Well, what do we do to catch up? You said there's some options there.
We're going to have to get serious very quickly in the fall. Really, getting a quick and important handle on diagnosing what kids' needs are, tutoring, providing one-on-one support for the kids who need it most, special education services. But it's going to be tricky because in the fall, most states are expecting significant budget cuts, maybe 20% cuts or more to state budgets. And of course, there's all the social distancing requirements and everything that schools will have to be coping with. So I think of it as a perfect storm, really coming together and making educators' jobs very difficult if we don't help them out.
I have an 11-year-old who just finished fifth grade. And one of the things that struck me while she was at home doing, a once-a-day, hour-long Zoom call with her class was that at one point, one of her teachers said to her, I haven't even seen XYZ classmate on any of these Zoom calls in weeks. To what extent do you think kids just weren't showing up to school?
Yeah. Well, a lot of them weren't. A lot of them really have disengaged. We know that high school kids in particular, many of them are just missing. School districts are not always even taking attendance, which is a little alarming to me. But when they are, some school districts are finding that, Providence, Rhode Island has something like 36% of their kids just chronically absent right now. So, finding ways to re-engage students once we have them back in the classroom and getting better at this remote learning thing, because realistically, many of them will have to continue to be online next year, at least part-time.
To that point, does it make sense to even let kids move on to the next grade in the fall? Should we just have a nationwide pause here where we say, okay, every fifth grader in the country kind of has to do fifth grade again? Or is that going a little too far?
Yeah, some folks have proposed that. It's enormously unpopular with parents. I can tell you from the surveys. They hate the idea. And really, I don't think there's need for it. And great educators know how to address learning gaps and really accelerate kids quickly if we give them the tools. Now, that's what's critical here is we just can't, leave them without a lot of supports. And I think it's important that districts start working with states, where states can provide tutoring programs and things that can be helpful. The federal government needs to really help with, the digital divide, making sure that all kids have the tools they need to be successful. So it is possible. I don't think we need to hold kids back. We need to accelerate them very quickly.
I heard you say that it's very likely kids will be continuing to do remote learning in the fall, again, giving parents something of a heart palpitation here. But so do you think that's what we should be doing? Considering how advanced some of the outbreaks are in hotspots around the country, should we just go ahead and say that's the way school is going to be in the fall?
Well, I think at the very least, we need to make sure that all families, all students have access to that option should they need it. So, many families and kids will have health concerns of their own. Many teachers have health concerns that will prevent them from coming back to the classroom. So, I like to think about options, having a lot of tools available for families to be able to meet their individual needs. And, places like Florida, who have experienced a lot of hurricanes and crises in the past, ask school districts all to have remote learning plans should they need it. So that seems like a reasonable thing for me. Ideally, we get kids back in classroom, in the classroom and having fun with their friends.
What I'm hearing you say is concerning, to say the least. So Before I let you go, please give me a bright spot, something that we can be optimistic about, something we've learned maybe over the course of the last few months.
Yes. You know, most kids will prefer to be learning in person, but many of them have told researchers that there are things about remote learning that they really love, kind of a more of an individual approach, being able to move at their own pace through things. Many educators also are finding that there were technology tools they didn't know about that are really helpful to them. So, you know, nobody wanted this all to happen. But I do think that there will be some things that we can grab moving forward and, accelerate us into something that may be more effective long term. And especially that will help us really address the equity issues that the crisis is revealing in education and elsewhere, but we were able to ignore. We can't ignore it anymore.
Robin Lake is director of the Center for Reinventing Public Education with a look at what school might look like in the future and how far kids have fallen behind in the past couple of months. Robin, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you. Great to join you.
And what do you think? How did that school year go for you and your kids? Remote learning. Are you worried about next year? We'd love to hear from you at hereandnow.org.
So here's the tally. The number of COVID-19 cases reported in the U.S. has now passed 2.5 million, with more than 125,000 deaths. And the number of daily new cases is now rising in more than half of the states. Meanwhile, protests against racism and police use of force continued over the weekend in Washington, St. Louis, Denver, Atlanta. Derek Thompson has been watching the pandemic and the protests and sees in both a failure of American institutions. Derek is senior editor at The Atlantic. He joins us from Washington as he does every Monday. Hi, Derek.
Hello.
So flesh it out, the pandemic and the police use of force in many of the protests and also causing the protests in the first place with the death of George Floyd show the failure of American institutions. What do you mean?
I mean that in this terrible, terrible year, the theme that combines the twin crises of police brutality and the failures of our public health system, the failures across the police and the CDC and the FDA, are a failure of institutions, a failure of agencies that are designed to keep us safe and secure, and in many cases are doing the exact opposite. So the failures of the police are easily stated. They're shooting and killing way too many people, a disproportionate number of whom are minorities. But the public health infrastructure has also had just a calamitous year. The CDC failed to track early COVID cases, failed to expedite initial testing kits. Their first kits were contaminated and unusable. And the FDA has often stood in the way of fast-tracking testing and treatment. And so what I was looking at in this piece is what causes it? Why do we have this failure across these institutions that should be keeping us safe?
Well, and you write, the reason is that our institutions are in part choking on the dust of a dead century. What do you mean?
I mean that in so many quarters of American leadership, it seems like these institutions are focused on the risks and anxieties of the late 20th century, and they're not paying attention to the actual risks of the 21st century. They are stuck in a dead century. So what does that mean? It means that we're prepared for wars against states and militant groups, but not against stateless forces like pandemics and climate change. It means that as far as the police go, we are arming and empowering law enforcement like it's 1990 and urban crime is at historic highs, when in fact, in the last 30 years, crime rates have fallen by more than 50% in just about every single American city, and yet we're still killing 1,000 people every single year in terms of the police. So there's a lot of reasons why we might be biased toward the status quo across institutions. You could say it's polarization. You could say it's about anti-expertise politics. You could even say maybe this is about gerontocracy, meaning that our leadership is too old across the country. And indeed, whoever wins in November this year will be the oldest president in American history. But the point is that we can't just blame Trump. There is institutional rot beyond the White House that afflicts all of these agencies that should be keeping us safe.
Okay, let's take it up. First of all, law enforcement, and we are hearing police departments say that they are training rookies differently now, but they put them out in cars with veterans and things change. you know, that they can't fight the forces of the older police who have been fighting with a different fighting. That's an appropriate word, with a different mindset, crime on the streets. And also there are police who say, wait a second, you're accusing me of fighting crime as if it were high. If I don't, high crime rates will return, or you don't see what I have to see. I'm remembering the officer in tears talking to protesters, white officer, coming back from the shooting death of a little girl who was caught in gang crossfire. He was saying things like, her life matters. I was there. So you know, got a lot of conflicting forces here.
Yeah, I think this is really, it's complicated, but let me try to make it as simple as possible. I think we need the police. I think we need effective policing, period. I also think that we should unbundle the police. I think the police do a lot of stuff that they just shouldn't do. You've seen a dramatic decline in inpatient mental health spending since the middle of the 20th century. So a lot of people with mental health problems aren't in facilities, they're out on the streets. And police who aren't trained as social workers or behavioral therapists have to essentially play the duty of both. They have to essentially be mental health specialists for people dealing with these crises. I don't think we should be having police doing that. I don't think we should be having armed police doing that. I think that's a fantastic example of how we've taken this blunt 20th century instrument of armed policing and asked it to do the 21st century job of dealing with America's mental health crisis. Mm. It's totally inappropriate. We need to deal with 21st century crises with 21st century tools.
I just want to quickly touch on the health institutions. We only have a minute here. Taking away the leadership, a president who didn't think, you know, masks should be worn, that kind of thing. The CDC was founded in the 1940s with a mission to stop an epidemic. What went wrong? How to make it right? You only got a 45.
Sure. Yeah, to make it as simple as possible, the CDC, ironically, was founded in the 1940s to stop an epidemic. Its first 400 employees based in Atlanta were tasked with stopping the outbreak of malaria in the Southeast. How ironic that 80 years later, they are incapable of being helpful in terms of stopping, reducing the caseload of yet another epidemic. I think it has to do with the fact that in the last 80 years, it has expanded to become a huge scientific research center that has lost the quick twitch instinct to actually achieve its founding mission.
We'll take you up on that again. Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. Thanks as always.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.